This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Some of the biggest news of the week likely happened while you and I were sleeping. Congress started and stopped the shortest government shutdown in American history. What politics were at play during those 5.5 hours when the government was at a standstill? And what's next? We'll talk about all that and more today on the Friday News Roundup. Joining us this week is Ayesha Roscoe, White House correspondent for Reuters. Ayesha, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
We're glad to have Celine Nazito back, based in Pittsburgh, a reporter for the Washington Examiner, a contributor for CNN, and a columnist for the New York Post. Celine, glad to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Also back with us is Greg Ipp, chief economics commentator at the Wall Street Journal and the author of Foolproof: Why Safety Can Be Dangerous and How Danger Makes Us Safe. Greg, good to see you again.
Good to see you.
It'll also be good to get your questions and thoughts about the week's top stories. Email 1A at WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page where you can watch our video stream or tweet us at 1A. Let's begin with Congress. After a series of short-term spending bills, a brief government shutdown, and a briefer government shutdown, Congress has finally approved a bipartisan two-year budget agreement. The deadline was missed last night after Republican Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky objected to parts of the bill.
The reason I'm here tonight is to put people on the spot. I want people to feel uncomfortable. I want them to have to answer people at home who said, how come you were against President Obama's deficits, and then how come you're for Republican deficits? Isn't that the very definition of intellectual dishonesty?
That was Kentucky Senator Rand Paul objecting to parts of the bill last night. President Trump announced in a tweet this morning that he signed the bill. He wrote, quote, just signed bill. Our military will now be stronger than ever before. We love and need our military and gave them everything and more. First time this has happened in a long time. Also means, in all caps, jobs, 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 unquote. Ayesha Roscoe, let me start with you. What are some of the major highlights of the bill? What did it take in this budget deal to finally get something to the president's desk that he could sign?
Well, it had the big increases in military spending, but it also had some things to kind of sweeten the pot for Democrats. It had, you know, increases in opioid spending. It had some things that would help with child care. It had, you know, these things that Democrats have been pressing on in domestic spending increases that had been capped under the last administration and that had been capped because Republicans were saying we need to watch the deficit. So it was a compromise between the two parties, but it seems to have left a lot of the far kind of right conservatives really upset that that Democrats were able to get these increases in domestic spending.
Yeah, Celine Nazito, I was just going to start to ask you about some of that. I mean, this was a bipartisan bill, so each side had to compromise or to give a little in order to get this thing done. What were some of the other compromises that had to be made?
Well, I think what's really important to note before I answer that is that this is the kind of thing that voters specifically said they wanted from a Trump administration. Not that he had anything to do with this, but that they wanted this as part of their revolt against Washington to see both sides work together. I think sometimes in the sort of aftermath of still being sort of surprised that Donald Trump won this election and what it all means, we miss the importance of working together was for the American voter on both sides of the aisle. So I think that's an important thing to note about what happened last night. I was listening to Tim Ryan this morning talk about it in an interview, and he is a Youngstown Democrat, sort of the Rust Belt Democrats that have become more and more extinct, along with Southern Democrats, about getting some of the components in government that Rust Belt Democrats and Republicans feel are important, like money invested into the communities with the opioids. So, you know, there was some compromise on that. That's the kind of thing that brought Democrats over. It's also the kind of thing that kept the Freedom Caucus Republicans away from it.
You know, Greg, the debate over DACA has been a big point of contention in the budget deal. President Trump took to Twitter Tuesday to pressure Democrats to kind of bargain with Republicans on a deal. He wrote, quote, and this is from Tuesday. Quote, polling shows nearly 7 in 10 Americans support an immigration reform package that includes DACA, fully secures the border, ends chain migration, and cancels the visa lottery. If D's, Democrats, oppose this deal, they aren't serious about DACA. They just want open borders, unquote. Now, it's worth noting that the four things the president mentioned are his four parts of what he wants from an immigration deal. I'm not sure what poll he's referring to. Maybe there is one, maybe there's not. I really can't answer that. But the fact is that Democrats said they were holding the line on this because of DACA. Where does DACA stand now?
Well, if you go back about three or four weeks, the Democrats felt that this was so important that they essentially allowed the government to shut down in hopes of getting a deal on allowing these dreamers to stay. They realized that that was a political loser. They caved. And essentially, they caved again because the latest spending deal doesn't address immigration. It leaves the entire question kind of still up in the air. The bottom line is that there isn't yet agreement between the president and either party in Congress that can get a bill passed. The president wants, yes, we'll protect the dreamers, anywhere from 690,000 to 1.8 million of these illegal immigrants who came as children. But what he wants in return is $25 billion for a border wall. He wants an end to the diversity lottery. He wants much less family reunification, immigration. All those are red lines for Democrats. And Mitch McConnell has said that he's not going to like move on an immigration bill that cannot get enough Democrats to pass a 60-vote threshold. Over in the House of Representatives, Paul Ryan has said he's not going to bring a bill that the president won't agree to. So we actually essentially have two mutually exclusive positions and no resolution in sight.
It's the Friday News Roundup with Greg Ipp of The Wall Street Journal, Selena Zito of The Washington Examiner, and Aisha Rasko of Reuters. Also with regards to DACA, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi spoke on Wednesday, this record-breaking speech, 8 hours on the floor of the House, to address how the budget deal did not include a concrete solution for DACA.
Our basic request is honor the House of Representatives. Give us a chance to have it vote on the floor.
There's House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Aisha, where does this leave Democrats in terms of the push to deal with DACA now? There's this deadline on March 5th set by the president for DACA to disappear. Nancy Pelosi said before the vote she didn't approve the budget, but she wasn't going to whip the rest of the House Democratic caucus and say, you better vote like I vote, which kind of speaks to how this budget moved forward. So now what? Does that mean the Democrats are out of leverage?
I don't know if it means that they're out of leverage, but they're definitely in a difficult position. They're going to have to do some type of political maneuvering to try to get a deal that would be acceptable to them. Or if they can't get a deal acceptable and nothing passes, and I guess the plan is to run and focus on the midterms and say, this is why you need to get Democrats in office, because these dreamers are at stake. Now, the issue with that is that they have a base that is often upset and feels that the Democrats don't have enough backbone, that they're letting themselves be pushed around, and that this is an issue for which that they should have really gone to the wall for. They really should have fought harder for it. And so when you're trying to get your base out in the midterms, but they feel that you're caving, I think that's kind of a conflict.
You've got a number of comments on the budget to share. Politics Watcher wrote on our website, the1a.org, leave it to Republicans to run up a vast deficit during a strong economy after attempting to balance the budget during a recession. Arlene M. responded, and when the economy crashes again, a Democrat will be elected president and get blamed. Then the GOP will go into we need to balance the budget mode. Selena, what about that? There was that comment from Rand Paul that I think honestly probably rings pretty true for a lot of people, including critics of Republicans, this idea of deficit spending that came up during the debate over the tax law. And although I'm sure nobody was, that plenty of people were upset with Rand Paul for holding up the process, there is something I think he said that resonates with a number of people, that this whole issue of deficit spending strikes a chord.
Well, something happened between 2010 Tea Party, where everything was about the deficit and spending, and 2016 election cycle. And that is that both parties are realigning with different components of each other going into each side. And a lot of what you saw in 2016, not just with the election of the president, but also in some of these House and districts and state legislative districts across the country, is the growth of what I call the New Deal Republican, right? They're descendants of the New Deal Democrats. They're their children's children. And while they have a lot of conservative ideology, they don't have the great sort of upset and outrage on spending that the Tea Party Republicans did. And they have this sort of loose relationship between each other, this coalition, and it's not, I'm not clear as to where it goes. But right now, the Republican Party is a little more Democrat than it was in 2010. And I outlined in my upcoming book, The Great Revolt, this is the challenge for the party.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a theme that we will be talking about much more as we get closer to the midterms. We will continue talking about the news of this week with Selena Zito, Greg Ipp, and Ayesha Rasko. Still to come, much more to discuss with confusion over a security clearance in the White House and the battle over one of our audience's favorite topics, gerrymandering. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with Reuters' Ayesha Rasko, The Washington Examiner's Selena Zito, and The Wall Street Journal's Greg Ipp. We always love to hear from you about anything that's in the news that's on your mind. Comment on our Facebook page, where you can also watch our video stream, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Before we keep going, Greg Ipp, there was something that you wanted to share.
Sure. So I think Selena made a good point that Republicans are now comfortable with spending the way Democrats used to be. But I think what sometimes forgotten is that even though Democrats used to be for more spending and Republicans for less, both parties at some level agreed that whatever you spent, taxes should align with your spending so that you're not borrowing the difference. What's unique about this period is that this massive spending increase, which, by the way, if it's extended, as it almost certainly will come to about $1.7 trillion over 10 years, comes less than 2 months after we just passed a $1.5 trillion tax cut. All that money gets put on the nation's credit card. The deficit next year as a result of these actions will probably be larger than $1 trillion. You can have big deficits when the economy is in recession, but this is a full employment economy, and we will have historic levels of debt exceeding even what we saw after World War II relative to the size of the economy when we head into the next recession. So while there might be a lot of political comfort for the new Republican Party in what it's just done, it is economically incoherent, and I think we have yet to see the real pain and the difficult decisions that entails.
A few more of your comments on the budget before we keep going. Rick asked, when did the U.S. stop spending money on the military? Trump makes it sound as if we stopped paying for the military until he showed up, like everything else he mentions. MRH emailed, did they just pass a 700-page piece of legislation without reading it? Is this any way to run a country? Ayesha, I take Rick's point about military spending. There have been issues over the last few years about the proper amount of funding for the military we need for the future. But to MRH's point, how did this go? Like, I'm sure they didn't reread all 700 pages before they voted early this morning.
No, I'm sure they didn't. And this is a complaint that often comes. It usually comes from the party that's in the minority. They say, we're passing things. We don't even know what's in it. And the majority kind of just throws their hands up and say, this is the way things work. I think there is an argument that because we've been going like with 3 week CRs and just kind of governing and truthfully.
CRs, continuing resolutions. To basically keep funding the government the way we funded it.
Yeah, because you've had all these deadlines for government funding, there can be an argument made that it was better to just get this deal done. So at least you have 2 years where you have some breathing room and you're not always under the threat of a government shutdown.
And we should be clear, this budget plan is not just another continuing resolution. This is a budget. Yes. This is a proper budget.
Yes.
Okay. Better late than never. Let's shift gears from Congress to the White House, where President Trump has asked the Pentagon to plan a grand parade of the United States Armed Forces in Washington this year. It would be to celebrate the military, something including marching soldiers and tanks. It was an idea he apparently had when he went to the Bastille Day celebrations in Paris last year. Celina Zito, do we know any details about this request and about how it's been received by the Pentagon? My guess is that they've basically just said, yes, sir, we'll figure something out.
Well, that's probably what the Pentagon's answer is going to be. You're the commander in chief. That's what you want. That's what we'll do. I remember when he attended the Bastille Day ceremonies. He found it. And there were plenty of reports saying that he found that, patriotic and inspiring. And it's something that he has always sort of been part of his personality. He loves grandiose things. So it shouldn't be a surprise to any of us that he would like this. This is something that it's not unprecedented. It's been done before. I think the last one was 1991, if I'm remembering correctly. So we have done it before.
After Desert Storm, I think, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And if I remember correctly, there were tanks and there were crazy looking missiles in that as well. But, he is going, because the criticism from people who oppose the president has always been he's too nationalistic. This is what dictators do. Their critics are going to, double down on that point of view. It would be nice if there was something done to sort of celebrate the marking of the end of World War I, which was one of the big event that America was involved with across the world. But there's a lot of pushback too from former military and present military that think it's just over the top. We shall see. Like anything that he does, it's always controversial because no one's ever been like him before in the White House.
It is worth noting, I did a little bit of digging on this Bastille Day parade. This was something that was started in the 1780s after the storming of the Bastille under the government that Napoleon Bonaparte overthrew. It's a parade that goes from the Arc de Triomphe to the Place de la Concorde in Paris. It's been held for different reasons on different years. Back in the 90s, it was held with soldiers from Eurocorps to symbolize European integration. After the 9/11 terror attacks, there were surviving firefighters from the Fire Department of New York who marched in this parade alongside cadets from West Point. So this parade takes place for a variety of different reasons. It's not always the exact same commemoration. And last year's was to partly mark the United States' entry into World War I in 1917. Aisha?
So I was with President Trump when he was there for Bastille Day in Paris. And so I saw the parade. It was amazing. And then I saw his response to it, which was, he was very excited about the, all the military hardware and things like that. I think it'll be interesting. Senator Lindsey Graham had said he would be interested in a parade, but just honoring the veterans without all the military hardware. So if people want to honor the troops, but don't want to be seen as, but don't want a big parade, something that looks like something out of North Korea. It would be interesting if the Democrats take the position, let's do it and honor the veterans, but not without the military hardware.
And Greg Ip, it's also worth noting, I mean, we trot out military hardware all the time, as anyone who has watched the Super Bowl can attest, or anyone who's been to Fleet Week in San Francisco can attest. But part of the issue with this also, I think, is just logistical. I mean, there's not that much military hardware in and around Washington, D.C. Like, the leadership is here, but the garrisons and the barracks and where the tanks are stored, there's no tanks within, like, 10 miles of Washington, D.C.
Well, yeah, it's expensive. And if you live in and around Washington, D.C., you know the roads aren't great at the best of times.
Right.
Just try driving on them after an M1 Abrams tank has been wheeling up and down for a few hours. So the city of Washington has said, like with the wall, Mr. Trump, you're going to have to find a way to pay for it. I think for the military, there's sort of mixed feelings. I think that a lot of people feel like the military and their families have made a lot of sacrifices over the last 20 years. It's entirely appropriate and good that they may recognize in some way. But there's an element of the military that also prides themselves on the quiet pride of getting their job done without all this fanfare. There was a tweet that got a lot of attention this week from Robert O'Neill. He's the former Navy SEAL who pulled the trigger that killed Osama bin Laden. He said, "A military parade is third world BS. We prepare, we deter, we fight." So there's definitely a kind of a mixed feelings, to say the least, between people who say this is an appropriate gesture of pride and strength and those who feel this is not the way the United States does it.
In terms of how to pay for it, Ken is listening in Alexandria, just across the Potomac from here, and Ken writes, prediction, the big defense contracting companies like Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and Northrop Grumman will commit to paying most or all costs associated with Trump's parade to score points with the president and show off their latest weaponry. On Monday, during a visit to a company near Cincinnati, President Trump accused Democrats of treason for not standing and applauding during parts of his State of the Union address. Here's part of what the president said in Cincinnati.
It got to a point where I really didn't even want to look too much during the speech over to that side, because honestly, it was bad energy. No, it was bad energy. You're up there. You've got half the room going totally crazy, wild. They loved everything. They want to do something great for our country. And you have the other side, even on positive news, really positive news like that, they were like death and un-American. Un-American. Somebody said treasonous. I mean, yeah, I guess why not? You know. Can we call that treason? Why not? I mean, they certainly didn't seem to love our country very much. But you look at that, and it's really very, very sad.
That was President Trump speaking in Cincinnati this week. By way of context, here is the legal definition of treason. Whoever, owing allegiance to the United States, levies war against them or adheres to their enemies, giving them aid and comfort within the United States or elsewhere, is guilty of treason and shall suffer death. Be clear, treason is a capital crime under U.S. law. But Aisha, I wonder if this is one of those things we should even be paying attention to. I mean, the president says outrageous things all the time. I can't really tell that there's been any fallout from this. Is this just like another thing that he said off the cuff that he didn't really understand the impact of, or were there larger effects?
I think that because so much is happening all the time with this administration, it's hard to focus on any one statement. But I think that overall, when you have a president joking about his political opponents and saying that they're guilty of treason, I think there's a larger impact to the culture, to the way we talk about each other, to the way you talk about your kind of political adversaries. He also said in that clip that it seemed like they didn't love their country. And so, you know, when you get, if a Democrat becomes president or someone else gets in power and they're accusing Republicans of not loving their country, you kind of see this kind of deterioration of our kind of political culture.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Selena, I don't want to linger on this too long, but what about you? Do you see any real impact of the president saying this, or is this just another off-the-cuff thing he said?
It just reminds me of that observation I made after my interview with him in September 2016 that I got from my friend Brad Todd. People take him seriously, but not literally, and we in the press take him, everything he says, literally, but we don't take him as seriously. I don't think that's ever changed. And to Alicia's point, this is what he does. He uses words in a different way than any other politician ever has, let alone a president. And, you know, it's part of the fire hose that we drink out of every day.
Greg Yip, I do want to move on to another controversy, another scandal out of the White House, really, involving a White House aide who resigned after two of his ex-wives accused him of physically abusing them. His name is Rob Porter. He's denied these claims. The issue, it seems, is that some White House staffers reportedly knew about these allegations. What do we know about Mr. Porter and about what they reportedly possibly knew?
So first of all, Mr. Porter is somebody that is almost invisible to the public, but plays an extremely important role inside the White House. He's the staff secretary. He basically controls the flow of documents and information to the president. He is one of the most trusted and important advisors to Chief of Staff John Kelly. I'm using the present tense. I believe he's now resigned, I should say. Because he's a White House appointee, he did not need Senate confirmation. But during a background check by the FBI over a year ago, his ex-wife told the FBI of incidents of domestic verbal and physical abuse that they experienced. This information was apparently at some point communicated to the White House, including to John Kelly. It remains unclear, and maybe Aisha can weigh in on this, specifically what Porter or the FBI communicated to John Kelly and what they knew. But it was puzzling why, up until Wednesday, I believe, the White House continued to insist on the integrity and the confidence they had in this guy until he resigned after some very, very disturbing photographs of this alleged abuse came to light.
Yeah, Aisha, I did want to ask you about that, particularly because White House Chief of Staff John Kelly came under some criticism for publicly defending Porter at first. Do we have any idea of what the White House knew and when?
Well, there have been differing stories, and there are reports that John Kelly did know something, that there were some allegations against Rob Porter. There's some talk that he maybe misled them or that he, you know, downplayed what he was accused of. McGahn, according to reports, at least on four occasions, knew something about this and was even contacted by an ex-girlfriend who was concerned about Rob Porter and his behavior in their relationship. I think that the big issue is you have a person who has allegations against him from his ex, from both ex-wives, that he was abusive. And it just seems as if the administration did not want to look any further into it or didn't take enough action that you would expect. This is an administration that if they find someone who has said something bad about President Trump, they will not bring that person into this administration. If you've written a bad column or sent a bad tweet about President Trump, they will not bring you in. But here you have someone who has credible allegations of physical abuse, and he was able to stay in this administration for 13 months.
Yes, Selena Zito, what does this mean for the White House going forward in terms of who it lets into the inner circle? I mean, does this have any lingering effects, or is this Rob Porter situation a little bit more of an isolated incident?
Well, we'd like to think it's an isolated incident. I think this goes to a larger problem that, you know, I've seen with this White House and I've seen with previous White Houses, is they begin to distrust, they believe that everyone is against them, right? And they believe, they begin to mistrust any information that's given them because they think and believe that people are out to get them, whether it's the news or, you know, it's the FBI, because there's a distrust there. And that's a problem that is not just in this White House. I mean, that's sort of the heart of the whole fake news phenomenon, in that people don't trust larger institutions and they don't trust expertise. And I think you see that in this White House, and I think that's what they got caught up with in the Porter case.
We got to pause in just a moment, but I would like to back up to some of your comments about this idea for a military parade. When we continue, we will talk about some of what's more stories in the news, including what's been going on Wall Street. Mike emailed, "Let me speak for every service member. We don't like being politicized, and we don't like having to do ceremonial drills more than is absolutely necessary. Also, did we win a war or something when I wasn't looking?" And another listener tweeted, "Why are we considering a parade when we have veterans sleeping on the street and can't find a job?" Greg Yip, I think that was one of, I'm glad that this listener brought up a comment about veterans, and we got to pause in a moment, but that was one of the issues that I think the Trump administration moved on early in his administration, with new laws spearheaded by the head of the VA about cleaning up the VA and getting people in the system who were dragging the system down out very quickly.
That's right. I think the administration has prioritize fixing the VA. And of course, one of the key issues in the budget showdown was adequate financial resources for the military. So whatever you think of this parade, I don't think you can, you know, diminish what the president's been trying to do in terms of adequately funding military and veterans.
Well, athletes say they're always going to Disney World after they win a national title. But what about a visit to the White House? Philadelphians are still flying very high after the Eagles won the Super Bowl, but there's a little controversy about the aftermath of that victory. We will get into that as the Friday News Roundup continues with Greg Ipp, chief economics commentator for The Wall Street Journal, Selena Zito, reporter for The Washington Examiner, Aisha Roscoe, White House correspondent for Reuters, and with you. More of your questions and thoughts in just a moment. Stay close. Before we get back to the roundup, we would love your help with Monday's program about gerrymandering. In Pennsylvania, lawmakers are under a court order to redraw the congressional maps, and the Supreme Court is considering two cases that could determine the future of partisan gerrymandering. How do you feel about the map of your congressional district? Is it fair? Is it unfair? Why? Tell us your story. 855-236-1A1A. What does a fair legislative map look like? How has the map where you lived affected you, positively or negatively, and why? Leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. That's 855-236-1212, and we will share some of your stories Monday on 1A. Back now to the Friday News Roundup with Aisha Roscoe of Reuters, Selena Zito of The Washington Examiner, and The Wall Street Journal's Greg Ipp. Let's talk about Wall Street. It has been a really volatile week. The stock market faced a steep drop Monday afternoon. It dropped 1,175 points, the worst trading day point decline in history. But more recently, yesterday, the Dow dropped more than 1,000 points. Greg Ipp, it has basically erased most of its gains from the last 3 months, except for, I think, a few hundred points. What is going on?
Well, first of all, 1,000 points sounds like a lot, but in percentage terms, it's really not that lot, if it's that much. If it feels volatile, it's partly because we have been sort of like coddled into not realizing that stock markets go up and down. The bull market is 9 years old. We haven't had a 20% bear market in that whole time, which is an extraordinarily long period of time. In some sense, the volatility, although it's been high, is kind of a return to normal. The initial reason for it was because there were signs that there might be a little bit of inflation pressure out there, some higher wages, the federal government's going to borrow a lot of money for the tax cut and the spending agreement we've just been talking about. High interest rates are traditionally bad for stocks, so that was a trigger for people to get out. At the same time, we know that there are a lot of big institutional money players out there who've been putting on a lot of strategies that were sort of based on the assumption the market would not be volatile. Now that those assumptions are wrong, they need to get out, and that is exacerbating the selling. At this point, it looks more like a market event than an economic event.
What was behind those assumptions that the market wouldn't be volatile? Was that based partly on Donald Trump's election? I mean, that was what I think a number of people said. And what the president himself has said is, well, people thought the economy was going to drop when I showed up, but look how stable things are. Look how strong Wall Street was. And for 2017, it really looked like he was right.
Well, sure. I mean, you have an economy that's like now finally getting a strong head of steam, the lowest unemployment rate. Even before Trump became president, the unemployment rate had dropped to extremely low levels. The entire world is looking healthy, not just the United States, but Europe and China and Japan. It's a very optimistic time. You bring in a big tax cut, which is especially helpful to shareholders. Of course, the stock market is going to rally. And at the same time, they used to say that no economic expansion dies of old age. They're all murdered by the Federal Reserve. And the Fed has been unusually friendly for the last 7 or 8 years, saying we're going to keep interest rates close to zero and raise them ever so slowly. What has happened in the last few weeks is that I think some people have begun to question their assumption that the Fed would always be their friend. And that's kind of what created this scare.
That feels like that's been kind of, there's been this tenterhooks feeling, Greg. I don't know if you've seen it, but a number of people, every time the Federal Reserve was going to meet, every quarter, they're like, oh my God, is this going to be the quarter where they raise the interest rate? Is this going to be, you can't do this to us right now. Every single quarter, because things felt so strong. our friend Kai Rizdahl from Marketplace would elbow me in the ribs if I didn't remind you of his dictum that the stock market is not the economy. The stock market is not the economy. You can hear our conversation with Kai about this on our website, the1a.org. You can just search for his name, K-A-I. You'll find it in a program called Have We Ever Had It So Good? That's online at the1a.org. Let's head to Las Vegas, where casino mogul Steve Wynn of Wynn Resorts resigned as the chairman and CEO of his own company on Tuesday. This came amid allegations of sexual misconduct, as reported by the Wall Street Journal. Steve Wynn is an industry giant accused of harassing and assaulting female employees over a span of decades. Selena Zito, it's worth noting that Steve Wynn is not only a big name in Las Vegas, he's also been a big name in Republican politics as well. What's the larger fallout from this?
Well, he's actually been a big name in all of American politics. And before the 2016 election, he toyed with publicly whether he was going to support Bill Clinton or Donald Trump. But when he resigned from his own company, it was right before he resigned from the Republican National Committee, where he was the finance chair. So his face was attached to the Republican Party during this scandal. I think that he denied this initially and strongly and robustly, but in the end walked away, either for legal reasons or, you know, because there is a problem there. In American politics, no matter what party it is, when someone does something nefarious or is alleged of doing something nefarious, the opposing party always requests, hey, you need to return your money. That happened with Al Franken, and it's happened with Wynn. And I suspect what we are going to see is that people that took donations or the Republican National Committee that took money from Wynn are going to eventually, if not immediately, return the money.
Ayesha Roscoe, it seems like Las Vegas has been playing a bigger role in politics in general, not just Steve Wynn, but also Sheldon Adelson, another casino mogul who's partly been under fire over his management of the Las Vegas Review-Journal, the major newspaper there. I assume Las Vegas is not just becoming a political thing. I don't know if there's more to read into this or if Steve Wynn is kind of a singular figure, particularly because he's so larger than life, and that's the way he's built his whole image, right down to the burnished gold finish of the Wynn and the Encore on the Las Vegas Strip.
Well, I think Wynn is a big deal because he is such a large looming figure in Las Vegas, but he also has a friendship with President Trump, and that's been well known. And so I think that in this moment, when you have so much being talked about, sexual harassment and sexual assault, and you kind of have this uprising against that, to have someone so closely associated with President Trump who's accused of these things, when President Trump has been himself has been accused of these things, I think that is kind of what makes this big for this political moment.
We mentioned earlier that we'll be talking gerrymandering on Monday, but Selena Zito, I did want to come back to you for a second and just touch on that a bit, because this is a heating up political battle in Pennsylvania. Last month, Pennsylvania's state Supreme Court ruled that its legislative maps violate the Pennsylvania state constitution. Some state Republicans asked the U.S. Supreme Court to block that ruling, but the justices on the high court refused to do that, and now lawmakers in Harrisburg face a deadline to get these new maps together. Selena, where does that stand right now? How tough is this task? And I wonder if there are any, like, what repercussions are there if they don't get it done?
It's a hot mess.
Best political analysis I have heard all week long.
It is just a hot mess. I live here in Pennsylvania, and there is a special election going on in the district I live in, and yet that election on March 13th, that special election in Pennsylvania 18th Congressional District, will not be the same district because a month earlier than that, it's going to be changed. So, I don't have a problem with the ruling. I have a problem in terms of, just as an observer and someone who reports on this, I do have a problem in the timing of it. You know, you have like a 5-day window to change 18 congressional districts that has to be done by the state legislature, by our, you know, state constitution. But then the governor and the state legislature has a super majority of Republicans, but then it has to then be signed by the governor, who's a Democrat, in an election year. And there's a relationship between these two entities where they can barely get a budget passed every year. So I think this continues to be a hot mess, and I don't know how it ends up. I mean, by law, what should happen is that the if the governor and the state legislature cannot agree on a map, the Democratic-controlled state Supreme Court will then draw the lines. So there you have it.
So what you're saying is it's a hot mess.
It's a hot mess. Gotcha, it's chaos. Right. It's a mess.
Half-Breed Hero wrote on Twitter, a lot of talk about our rigged system, but in my opinion, the real rigging is being done in the form of gerrymandering during the redistricting process. What can we as average citizens do to thwart the direct manipulation of our most important civic responsibility? Good question, Half-Breed Hero. We will talk about this more on Monday, and we certainly hope to get some more of your stories about what's going on in your districts. For now, let's leave the earth and look up. There was a big story out of Florida this week, literally and figuratively.
3, 2, 1.
Falcon Heavy heading to space on our test flight. Building on the history of Saturn V Apollo, returning pad 39A to interplanetary mission.
That was the launch of the SpaceX Falcon Heavy, the world's most powerful rocket. It blasted off from launch pad 39. At the Kennedy Space Center in Florida on Tuesday. SpaceX is the company founded by Elon Musk. The Falcon Heavy was carrying another one of his projects, a Tesla Roadster, which is now floating in space. The rocket's boosters landed right back on Earth, two of them safely. Little tripods came out and landed perfectly. The third one, which was aiming for a floating launch pad in the water, crashed into the water. Greg Ipp, what makes this launch such a big deal other than the fact that it was really, really cool to watch?
Well, do not diminish just how cool it was to watch.
Right.
If you haven't, go out and watch the video. It is inspiring. It's exciting. Elon Musk is a great businessman, but he's also a great showman. I mean, not only did he launch this amazing rocket, but he put one of his own roadsters on the rocket with like a mannequin in a spacesuit playing David Bowie's Space Oddity on the radio.
Leaning out the window.
Yeah.
With
and,
one hand on the steering wheel and the other hand just on the side of the car.
The glove box is a copy of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I mean, it was just like an awesome kind of like, you know, over-the-top show. But the reason it's significant is that, look, it's been more than 50 years since the Apollo space missions. And I can't remember, but it's been some years since the last space shuttle blasted off. And the end of the U.S. space program has had a real feeling of diminishment of the national spirit, capability, excitement.
Almost 7 years. The last space shuttle
Thank
flight
you.
Was July 2011.
When you see mankind returning to space, or not so much returning to space, but these new exciting efforts, these new technological advances to return to space, I think it's inspiring. I don't think Elon Musk has yet demonstrated that this is a commercially viable long-term project, but he has demonstrated technology and most of all, you know, conviction and will that has been missing for a very long time. I just think it's an exciting moment.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. White House visits by sports champions are a long-held custom, but at least a few players on the Philadelphia Eagles are planning to break that tradition after winning the Super Bowl last Sunday. Here is what Eagles safety Malcolm Jenkins told CNN on Monday.
I know you've been asked this. Do you intend to go to the White House for a celebration?
No, I personally do not anticipate intending that.
What message would you like to send to the president?
I don't have a message for the president. You know, my message has been clear all year. I'm about, you know, creating positive change in the communities that I come from.
That's Malcolm Jenkins, a safety for the Philadelphia Eagles, speaking to CNN on Monday. Aisha Roscoe, what's the upshot of all this? The athletes don't have to go to the White House. They would not be the first athletes to turn down an invitation from the president, if the president even extends one. What's the upshot of all this?
Well, I think it has been interesting to watch President Trump's interaction with professional sports in general. He did rescind an invitation to the Golden State Warriors after Steph Curry said he wasn't coming. So it'll be interesting whether he even extends an invitation. He did congratulate them on Twitter. I think politically, what stands out to me about President Trump's interactions with football players, or lack thereof, is that the criticism that he has had, he's really used to fire up his base about this standing for the flag issue. And, you know, even, you know, kind of cursing about them, to saying they need to get those blanks off the field.
That they should be fired.
That they should be fired. He's used this to rouse his base, and they have been worked up about it. And this is something that has really spoken to them. So he's kind of use these players as kind of a prop to kind of help his standing with his base.
Selena, do you think that this still is effective? I mean, I don't think that anybody in Philadelphia is really too worried about what the president thinks. I don't believe Philadelphia went for Donald Trump, but I wonder how effective this is. Is this starting to die down as a cultural flashpoint, or does it still have a little juice?
Well, standing for the flag, I think, will always be important to, in particular, to the people that supported Donald Trump.
And I'm sorry to cut you short, Selena. We're just a little bit low on time. Go ahead.
So I'm kind of meh about this, in that this has happened. I'm old, so this has happened throughout my lifetime through a number of different presidents. And the beautiful thing about this country is, if you don't want to go, you don't have to go. And if you do want to go, you're going to have a great time.
One last story we wanted to share with you that comes out of Kansas, where politics apparently knows no age. Six teenagers are trying to prove that by running for governor this year. No, it's not a bunch of them stacked on top of each other's shoulders to look like one grown-up. There are six teenagers. They discovered that governor does not have an age requirement in Kansas. The House Elections Committee met this week to discuss a bill that would set the minimum age to 18 for a number of statewide offices. Here are four of the teenage candidates explaining why they're running.
I'm going to go and fight for what the people want, and I think when you give people that true, honest choice that is very rare in American politics, they're more likely to vote for you.
A youthful point of view in a field full of career politicians could be really good in Topeka.
Oh yeah, Ethan ran for governor? Yeah, that's something he'd do. Yeah, so it's nothing crazy. I haven't had any crazy reactions to it at all.
The four of us have a chance of winning this election. You may say, oh, well, we're not serious about it. We fit those legal requirements, and if we're running, we're in it to win it.
Why not run for class president?
Already did that.
Greg, I got to say, I like these kids.
I do, too. So some legislators in Kansas have said, well, you know, this is going to make us a laughingstock. And they're pushing an amendment that would require anybody running for governor to also be able to vote for governor.
Well, there's
which
that.
These, yeah. All I can say is, win or lose, these guys have a great topic for their college entrance essays.
Absolutely. I think if it came to them or me, I would not have made it. I would not have made it. Greg Ipp, chief economics commentator at the Wall Street Journal. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
Selena Zito from Pittsburgh joining us reporting for the Washington Examiner. Thanks, Selena.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Ayesha Roscoe, White House correspondent for Reuters. Thanks, Ayesha.
Thank you.
Weekends are a great time to revisit the roundup or any of our conversations, so do check out the 1A podcast. And send us your stories about whether your legislative map is fair or not. 855-236-1A1A. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. Enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.